Welcome to You've Got Time, an Orange is the New Black podcast. As usual, I'm your hostess, Erin Quayle, and this week we did have a bit of a technical issue, but we're up and running today. So thank you so much for your patience with us. We're going live a couple days after we normally do, but we're all good now, and we're really excited about the news. Last week on Thursday, August 18th, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates recommended that the Department of Justice phase out the use of public prisons, which is incredibly exciting given the fact that obviously Orange is the New Black has been, private prisons have been a big part of seasons 3 and 4 of Orange is the New Black. And we can't help but think that Orange is the New Black was, instrumental in bringing private prisons to a whole new light in the public eye. So thanks to that, and also to, obviously Shane Bauer's amazing piece of journalism in Mother Jones, where he went undercover as a prison guard for 4 months in a private prison down south, that, those two things did, probably did a lot to bring those things to the fore and had people talking about them and thinking critically about the decisions that our government was making in the prison system. And it's a small step forward in the issues that our prison system and our justice system faces, especially in the fact of, it's not really going to decrease mass incarceration very much, but it is a step in the right direction in terms of thinking about prisoners more as humans and thinking about the system more as a system of rehabilitation instead of punishment and all of that. So it's very exciting, but unfortunately you won't hear us talk about that decision on this podcast as it was recorded last week on Wednesday the 17th. So nor will you hear us talk about it on the 10th episode because we recorded that a while ago, and you'll hear that next week. It's a really great talk as well. But on the 11th episode, we will definitely follow up on this story as it progresses, because they're kind of talking about, exactly how they're going to phase out those private prisons and what's going to happen to the inmates there and things like that. So we'll definitely be following up on that as it progresses. But this week, I was joined by Brad Tillis, who is a former journalist, and he's a current staff writer for Hidden Remote, the site that I am an editor on and write for, and we post these podcasts on. And we had a great talk about episode 9. We talked a little bit about we talked a little bit about everything that went on in the episode, but Brad had some specific experience with a program that helped children of incarcerated parents. So you'll hear us talk a little bit about that and all sorts of other stuff as well. We also talked a lot about food in this episode. Piper and Alex talk a lot about wanting a burger, and so we kind of riffed on that a little bit. So if you're hungry, you might want to grab a snack before listening. And in addition to that, we also are live tweeting episodes every single Monday night at 9 o'clock. Tonight, this episode's going to go up like a couple hours before we do the live tweet on Monday, August 22nd. But if you're around or if you hear this, we are going to be live tweeting the 10th episode of the fourth season of Orange is the New Black. I think it's called Bunny Skull. So we'll be doing that tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. And then every Monday following for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be doing an episode at 9 o'clock, and the next three episodes after, the 10th episode are doozies. So we'd really love for you to come join us and chat with us and tweet with us on Twitter. On Twitter, you can reach us at You've Got Time Pod. On Facebook, you can reach us at facebook.com/You've Got Time Podcast. And you can also shoot us an email at you've got time podcast@gmail.com. So hope you guys enjoy this conversation, and we are looking forward to talking to you more as we start to get into the meat of the end of the season, and the punches start coming pretty hard and some serious things start coming up. So like I said, I hope you enjoy this episode, and we will hopefully talk soon. Thanks so much. So this episode, it's the 9th episode, so we're like headed into the home stretch, and it's setting up a lot of stuff for the final 3 episodes. I know, you know, we try to like not give any spoilers. It's getting harder and harder to not give spoilers as we go on episode by episode. But we, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's leading up to like a big finale. So we'll tackle the small stuff first and make our way up to the bigger points in the episode. So the episode opens with Cindy and Judy King, which I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, it's interesting the whole how they introduced Judy King into the series beginning last season. And I remember even before, you know, being reported in the press how they were going to bring in a this type of character who is obviously is going to be a sort of a representative of I'm blanking on your name.
Martha Stewart. Or Paula Deen. Yeah. There's two. Yeah.
Yeah, Martha Stewart. But then when they sort of introduce her character and her past as sort of a not only a mogul but one with racist tendencies, that was obviously a nod to Paula Deen. And so now that Judy's in the prison, she's been slowly sort of acclimating herself while trying not to make any enemies with the inmates. And so now she's trying to bring in some favor with the black community, and as well as keeping her name in the spotlight by having this photo leaked of her kissing Cindy in the yard. And so obviously that, well, it seems like in the beginning of this episode, as the group of the inmates are watching the news coverage, all the rest seem to be pretty excited about any type of future fame because of their association with Judy King. But meanwhile, Cindy's just looking very disappointed that she's being exploited for this.
Because she's not even famous. It's like she says, what'd she say? Something like some brown puffs are famous or something. It's not me because yeah, we have to blur out her face.
And even in the news report, they don't identify Cindy. They cover her face up. And so Cindy's not even getting any
recognition. Well, thankfully,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Because she's in prison. So thankfully they hide her identity. But yeah, but she was hoping for fame and fortune, and the fortune's kind of on the way, but the fame didn't really come for her, so she's a little disappointed. But yeah, but then there's the whole, like, so there's that, and the girls are very kind of funny this season up to this point. You know, the whole time they've kind of been, like, messing around with Judy King. Poussey has the storyline with Brooke, and they actually have that funny line that, like, they're Kanye and Kim and Cindy and Judy are the Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Yeah.
but so that's kind of just going on, and Judy and Cindy fall into a pattern because obviously Caputo wants to see that they're actually quote unquote in a relationship and it's not quote unquote fake, even though he totally knows it is. But he's like, you have to keep up appearances. But then when they're all hanging out in Judy's room, Yoga Jones is all weird. And I was really kind of upset about that because Yoga Jones was previously friends with Watson, and Watson's in the room. And then Yoga Jones, once they leave, she's saying how she thinks that they're going to steal things. And it was just really disappointing to me to see that.
Yeah, because up until this point, she's always been one of my more favorite ones because how sort of laid back and likable she is. And but in the scene, she asserts that she's not targeting them because of their race, but because they're inmates. But I'm wondering, has she shown any other displeasure with inmates around her in terms of protecting her own possessions? Because that certainly seemed out of place.
I don't think so. Yeah, I it's very weird to me because she's one of, I mean, the show is very well written this season, but she's one of the characters that kind of did like a flip, like her, like that's not within her character to say, oh, I'm worried about, or maybe it is, I guess, now that she has all this privilege, maybe she's enjoying it a little too much, or it's kind of going to her head a little too much. But Watson's her friend, and I mean, from what we've seen, Watson is, they're at least friendly, and maybe she doesn't like Cindy, but she knows Watson, and who cares if someone steals her seltzer machine, like Judy King says. And it's funny because Judy King's the one who's kind of like, who cares if they steal things?
Yeah.
And Yoga Jones is the one who's like pushing back, and I didn't that made me feel a little gross. I didn't like that.
Yeah, same here.
But yeah, and so, you know, Yoga Jones was kind of a little bit of a change this season, but, you know, it's also kind of continues the conversation a little bit about racism, I guess, because someone has to be pushing against the two of them being together, since Caputo doesn't really seem to have any objections to it. And so Yoga Jones has to be the voice there, I guess, unfortunately. Too bad. But moving on to Piper and Alex, they're, you know, like I said, there's a lot of different components going on this episode, so we're just going to run down all the different relationships. But Piper and Alex kind of get a moment of levity after Piper's, you know, the heavy lifting of the past couple episodes with the swastika and the window and all of that. So they're talking about burgers, and they talk very eloquently about burgers, so much so that they kind of make me want a burger, but, you know, I'm out and free, so I can go get a Shake Shack burger whenever I want. But I got me kind of thinking, like, what food I would miss in prison. Do you have any foods that you think you might miss, like, if you were not able to have access to food?
Yeah, because I guess, I mean, I was thinking about this, sort of the cliche answer, and it would probably be, like, good pizza, because I can only imagine in prison, if they serve pizza, it'd probably be, like, that square cut, plain cheese, probably bland tasting, and it's just not very satisfying. And for me, like, I'm not, like, picky, but, you know, I love a good sausage and peppers pizza, or even, like, a New Haven-style pizza, thin crust. So something like that I'd definitely be missing.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and, you know, even when Red was cooking and everything wasn't from, like, a bag, I mean, I guess it was a little better, but it still wasn't that great. I mean, you still couldn't get, like, a big, delicious, juicy burger. But it was funny because I remember I read Piper Kerman's memoir, and I remember her saying something along the lines of, like, there were no vegetables at all. And then you see in season two where Piper gets furlough and she goes to her grandmother's wake or funeral or whatever she's at, and she's eating lettuce, and it's kind of like a nod to that in the book, I think, because she says, it's been so long since I've had a vegetable that crunched. And so I thought about that, and I was thinking, oh, well, maybe I would miss vegetables if I couldn't have any access. And that's such a boring answer, but it just, based on what I know about Piper, the real Piper, I was thinking about that, and I was like, well, that's boring, but it's something that I think I would miss.
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't read the memoir, but keep in mind, she came from sort of an affluent family, and so I'm sure she's used to healthy eating and you know, good food. So
true.
So that's probably just, you know, one of the more her basic necessities that she's now lacking in prison.
Yeah, that's very true. And my more exciting answer is pasta, because I could live on pasta every single day. Oh, but yeah. I'm sure I would miss, like, a delicious bowl of, like, I don't know, my favorite is, like, Annie's with, like, extra Parmesan and broccoli. So I would miss that. I think I would also miss being able to just, you know, you're hungry sometimes and you're like, oh, what do I want to eat? And then you think about it and then you go make it. And I think a lot of what has to do, you know, with food choices is, you know, if you can't choose your food, then that's the big part of missing out on freedom.
And I was actually thinking, you mentioned choosing a food, like, just as a hypothetical, you know, God forbid you ever commit a horrendous crime and you're sentenced to death row, where your last meal is basically your own request. And I was wondering if you actually ever thought, what would your last meal be?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know, probably pasta.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's actually, have you ever seen, there's like an article that was floating around, or I'm not sure if it was an article, but it was just like a slideshow of pictures of recreated last meals that different people had requested over the years. And some of them were, like, extremely interesting.
Actually, yeah, I probably saw the same one, because I remember two of them that stood out for me was John Wayne Gacy had a big plate of Kentucky Fried Chicken, in part because when he was living in Iowa, I think, he actually managed three KFC franchises.
Oh, really? Yeah, I don't remember what they were. I just remember them being, like, very, you know, I'll link to it when we put this up on Hidden Remote. But I just remember seeing them and being like, oh, that's not something that I would eat, but that's an interesting choice. But
and the other one I remember is Timothy McVeigh, who was the Oklahoma City bomber. His last meal was just a giant bowl of mint chocolate chip ice cream.
I mean, hey, whatever you're dreaming of, I guess. I mean,
yeah,
it's interesting that we give death row inmates that little perk, I guess. But I always think of The Green Mile, Stephen King's The Green Mile. And I think what happens at the end is that doesn't Tom Hanks' wife makes him something in the movie. I can't remember what happened in the book. I read the book so long ago, but she makes him just like a delicious home cooked meal. And I was like, that's probably what I would want. Like a delicious home cooked meal from like my aunt or my mom or something.
Yes. Yeah, it's comfort food, right?
Yeah. Like something made with love.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it'd probably just be like a big breakfast, like bacon and eggs, sausage, rye toast. No, something like that.
Oh, I do like eggs. Okay, you're making me hungry. But yeah, so I mean, they're talking about it in the episode too, and they're, like I said, they're being so eloquent about it and talking about all the specifics and saying, what is Alex says something like, "Oh, I want a milkshake too," and Piper's like, "Don't get greedy," and Alex says, "It's my fantasy, so you know you can fantasize about whatever you want." But kind of stepping a little sidestep, I was talking about Piper's memoir and how, you know, I read it and she said there weren't really any crunchy vegetables in the prison. But it's just funny because when we were kind of setting this discussion up, you mentioned to me that you had actually been to the Danbury prison where Piper Kerman had been held.
Yes. 10 years ago, actually, summer of 2006, I had just graduated from University of Connecticut, and I wanted to pursue journalism, but I didn't really have any job prospects. So I basically had to fall back on my job at CVS, where I was a pharmacy technician. And even though I liked working with the people there, it's just I was looking to see if I can earn more money elsewhere. And so I applied for a job at Danbury Hospital. And after I met with the HR rep there, she told me there was an opening in the pharmacy at the women's prison, which the hospital oversees all their healthcare services. And so one day I just went in for a tour of the facility, and I met with administrators there, and it was just like real eye-opening experience for someone like me who was, you know, living in a suburban bubble for most of my life. And when I got there, it's just a real, like, to-do in terms of security. When you enter one room, they have to securely lock the door behind you before they open the next door. And then I got the tour of the pharmacy itself, which was very tiny because most of the space to be for all the pharmaceutical inventory. And then the one of the pharmacists that was there that day, he must have been either a retired naval officer or in the naval reserves because he was wearing his dress whites and he just came off as very intimidating. And I just couldn't picture myself working for this guy. But then at the same time, I'm wondering, you know, maybe you have to have this tough demeanor in order to work in an environment like that. And then it's just like, for me, it was just a really overwhelming experience and I couldn't imagine myself working there. And so just the next day, I called them, the HR rep up and just said, you know, thanks, but please withdraw my consideration for the position. Right. And it just was not for me.
I'm sure they get that too frequently because, you know, it sounds like it was just like a depressing, hardcore place. And, you know, so many of our prisons are like that. And, you know, when you were at that, it's so funny because I live, you and I grew up very close to Danbury, which is funny, but I did not know there was a federal prison there until the show came out, until I read the memoir. And I was like, oh my God, Piper Kerman was, there's a federal women's prison in Danbury, which is very odd to me, especially since I grew up in Newtown, which I've mentioned on the podcast a couple times, but there's actually a high security prison. It's called Garner Correctional here. It's a maximum security prison for men. And when that was built, I remember being like, oh, a prison, like that's so odd. And then just knowing that another one, especially one that's as famous as Danbury, it was so close that I was just very surprised.
And yeah, actually speaking of the prison, the finale of last season's episode where, it takes place in the lake behind the prison. I actually looked up at the map and there's an actual lake behind the Danbury prison.
Oh, is there? That's so funny.
I have no idea if such a breakout took place at the prison where all the inmates just didn't actually run away, but just splashed around in the water. But at least when it came to shooting the show, they made sure to put a lake right next to Litchfield.
Yeah, it was accurate, I guess, at the very least. That's so interesting. And it's funny because I mean, I highly doubt that they would let me just tour the Danbury prison if I wanted to go there, because a lot of times, you know, prisons are very, you know, I'm a citizen, so why am I, you know, not someone who belongs in prison? I don't work there. And B, they're usually very closed about what's going on in the prisons. But it sounds like you just sort of toured the prison in terms of like an everyday work day, and there wasn't anything crazy there, but it was just not really the most friendly place.
Yeah, I mean, there was one at one point. There's a separate pharmacy, and then there's a separate room where they dispense the prescriptions to the inmates. And you know, the inmates just come up to a window. I guess you know, they give them a slip saying their name, what prescription they take, And I saw some inmates come in, pick it up. It was very routine, like an everyday occurrence. So nothing exciting, at least from my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because I worked in methadone clinics for a while, and we only dispense methadone and Suboxone. But, you know, when you're dispensing medications that could potentially be cheeked, which is kind of, you know, people keep medication in their cheek and then spit it out mm-hmm. if they don't want to take it or if they want to sell it or something like that. And I know how kind of soul sucking that type of work can be, especially with people that you have to like absolutely make sure that they take their medications. So I'm sure that that probably would have been part of your job as well, to monitor whether or not they were actually, you know, actually ingesting the medication instead of just cheeking it.
Yeah, I don't remember, but I'm sure like whoever's dispensing, you know, once they the inmate puts the pill in their mouth, they have to open their mouth wide to make it look like mm-hmm. to make sure that they're not hiding it somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, you know, a lot of people on psych meds, too. I mean, there's all sorts of different reasons to not take medication. Sometimes people just don't like the way that they feel on them, or they feel like they're being given medication unfairly or whatnot. And mm-hmm. so there's a lot of reasons to not take the meds. And it's interesting. And it's, you know, it's also interesting that you kind of got a chance to see that firsthand.
Yeah, yeah. And I think after I found out, you know, the show was based on a woman who actually served there, I don't know if you know what year she served, but I think I determined that
I actually looked it up as we were talking. She went in 2004, and it was 13 months. So conceivably, depending on when she went in 2004 and when you went in 2006, you could have been there when she was there.
Oh, really? Because I think when I looked it up a long time ago, and I thought there was no way that we would have her sentence was at the time when I was there. But I know it could be, so... Who knows?
Yeah, it just says in 2004 she served. I'm just looking it up on Wikipedia. Beginning in 2004, she served 13 months of a 15-month sentence at FCI Danbury, at minimum security prison located in Danbury, Connecticut. So, say she went in like December 2004 and came out February 2006. Then if you went in January, February 2006, then you would have mm-hmm. overlapped. But who knows? But it's just, you know, it's just a prison, and you know, there a lot of them are, I think, very similar in the fact that they're not very welcoming on the inside.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a liability issue for having an outsider who could be in harm's way.
Sure. That's true too. I mean, there's all sorts of different layers. Yeah, and like you said, with the technician there too, he was very stern and whatnot. And we've had some conversations on the podcast as to Piscatella specifically on the season and how to kind of maintain order in a prison when, you know, there are people there that are used to, you know, being manipulative or getting what they want or doing certain things. And sometimes you kind of do have to put those walls up because it's tough to manage otherwise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but kind of moving on to our next pair of friends, who I love these friends on the show because they're such an unlikely duo, which is Boo and Doggett. And they kind of get serious in the episode. We only really see them for a very brief period of time, but they are talking about Charlie Donuts. They call him Donuts, and I like calling him Donuts, too, because I think it's funny. But he apologizes. You know, he apologized last episode to Doggett, and Doggett is kind of trying to process that, and she's not really sure what to do with it. And Boo is like just furious. So I don't really know, like, what, like, the two are so different, and they're kind of, there's different, I don't really know what Doggett is thinking here.
Yeah, because the thing is with Doggett with me is she made for a great antagonist in the first season. Mm-hmm. And then it just seemed like after that the writers sort of wanted to tone her down and sort of kept her in the back seat. So over time, at least for me, she became more tolerable as a character. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, last season when she was raped in the van, you know, that was one of those moments I had to look away because it's so difficult to watch, you know, such a thing occur in TV and film. And then mm-hmm. as much as, you know, you might despise Doggett in the beginning of the series, her character definitely did not deserve to be harmed in such a horrific way.
No. Yeah.
And so now this season's bringing up the complicated issue of the aftermath. And it seems with Charlie, he generally thinks what he did was not rape or that he was in the wrong. Mm. And so now this whole brings up like rape culture as a whole and how the perpetrator might not know what he's doing is against the other person's consent. And so, I mean, I listened to the previous episode. I'm not sure if I think you brought up the Brock Turner case.
I did. Yeah. Because I just thought it was so interesting that, you know, in this in the season of Orange is the New Black, I think I read an article about how it's kind of challenging people to sympathize with aggressors. And Charlie's definitely an aggressor, but he's kind of the way that he was raised. He didn't really understand. But then once it's kind of brought to the forefront and he's Doggett kind of tells him, listen, this was not right. Like what you did was not at all what, you know, what you should be doing. He kind of does think about it. And then he does apologize. And I do think that the apology was genuine. And in the Brock Turner case, Brock Turner never once apologized for what he did. He never once recognized what he did. And I think that that was what caused such, you know, frustration and anger towards him throughout the time that his case was being tried. So I think I'm repeating myself previously, but yeah, that was definitely a comparison that I made.
Yeah, and then, I mean, for Doggett, the apology she felt was in the right direction, but then I was kind of surprised when she was talking with Boo that she admitted that the woman that Doggett shot that landed her in jail, she didn't deserve to die, and so it was rare to see Doggett express some type of remorse. But now
she did, yeah.
But with Boo now, Boo doesn't want to take any prisoners. She vows revenge against him. And so that's creating the wedge between her and Doggett.
Yeah. And I think, you know, now that sometimes it takes me like talking about something to really process it. And I think Boo is kind of thinking more along the lines of like Charlie Donuts or whatever. He's just apologizing so he can continue his, like, he doesn't really mean it. He wants to continue his relationship with Doggett without having to feel guilty about what he did instead of actually processing things and moving forward. And I think he is, because you also see him, you know, a couple episodes ago, you saw he was like, had his day off or whatever, and he and Loosecheck were playing video games, and one of the inmates comes in and she had cut herself, and he shows sympathy for her. And then in this episode, Sister is trying to get, you know, we'll get to that, but she's trying to get thrown in the shoe, and she like swears at him publicly and calls him an idiot or something, and he's basically just like, oh, Sister, is your blood sugar low? So you see him kind of treating the inmates like people, and I think that that's partially from his experience with Doggett.
I think you make a good point.
And Boo doesn't really see that, so she just kind of sees this perpetrator, and she's not really willing to forgive and forget. But I like what you brought up about Doggett too, because Doggett did something really horrible. You know, she killed someone. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't really, comparing the two crimes or apples and oranges, because they're both very heinous crimes, but Doggett killed a woman who totally didn't deserve it. And Boo tries to kind of explain it away. She wants to see everything in black and white, and it's not in black and white. And Doggett is kind of just really struggling with that. And Boo is not necessarily the person to be helping her through that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we'll, you know, and like I said, we try not to spoil future episodes, but we'll see that kind of play out as the season goes along.
Yeah.
But we do see that after Boo's discussion with Doggett, or Doggett approaches Boo, Doggett kind of removes herself a little bit from Boo, and she goes to hang out with all the like meth heads and white supremacists. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a funny exchange in the episode too. We kind of do get a little levity from them. We get, you know, the conversation that they have at lunch, which I thought was like, it was like so funny. It's always funny to see kind of, you know, you and I talk about TV and we write about TV a lot, but it's always kind of funny for me to take a step back and talk to people that don't really analyze or take TV as seriously as I do, because they're talking about Breaking Bad. And it's just so, did you watch Breaking Bad?
Yeah, actually,
I think you did.
Funny enough, just last week, I had an itching to revisit the last season of Breaking Bad, because I always thought that was the most compelling. And I literally just watched the finale yesterday. And so revisiting this episode, it's funny to see them, you know, trying to talk about Breaking Bad, but I don't think they even say the title. They just do their best to describe what's going on.
Right. It's like you have to guess what it is.
Yeah.
And they're talking about the blue meth, and she's like, oh, blue meth is not natural.
Yeah. And then they also mention they're trying to figure out a show on the USA Network involving either lawyers or the FBI. And the funny thing is just for me, so many USA shows are sort of interchangeable in terms of law enforcement and the criminal justice system. And I mean, I don't know if it's a knock on the USA's programming, but I don't know. I just thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a knock. And I actually tried to kind of like tease apart exactly, because they talk about four shows in there. They're like, what do they say? I wrote it down at one point and I don't know where it is, but they're saying something along the lines of, oh, it's the one about the lawyers, which I think is Suits. And then they're like, no, they're in the FBI, which I think is Motive. And then there's another one that they say, oh, they're in Miami, which I don't know what that one is. And then,
oh, that was, I think that was Burn Notice.
Oh, Burn Notice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then there's another one. And then they're like, oh, no, that's a doctor in New York, which is Royal Pains, which actually just ended. So yeah. I was like, I was going through all of these and I was like, OK, I don't watch any of these shows, but I know about them because obviously we talk about TV a lot on Hidden Remote. So I was trying to tease apart all the different things. And then when Doggett said I thought those were all one big show, I just lost it because they're really I don't know if it's I'm thinking, like, is it kind of a burn at the fact that they're all, like, white people on the shows? But I don't think so. I think there's a little diversity. I don't watch any of them, so I don't really know. I know there's an Indian woman on Royal Pains, but besides that, I think they're all pretty homogenous in terms of casting. So maybe that was a dig at casting?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, like you, I mean, the only show really I'm devoted to on USA is Mr. Robot, but
yes, and that could not have been clumped in with any of those other other shows.
And I think also because of I mean, I don't know how closely the writers are paying attention, but I mean, keep in mind, you know, we're in the fourth season, but 3 years have not passed over the course of the show. I think it's still under like a year and a half, so you know they Mr. Robot hasn't come into their universe yet.
Right. Ooh, I wonder what would happen if it did. Because, well, they did pick apart Breaking Bad in a very interesting way. Yeah. So I feel like I would love to see their commentary on Mr. Robot. Mm-hmm. That would be super interesting. but yeah, so they're talking about that, and that's like a super lighthearted part of the episode. But in addition, one of the girls, and I don't know her name, she's like a relatively new, like, quote unquote, white supremacist girl. She's talking to the girl with the Confederate tattoo on her neck while as they're shoveling. And the Confederate girl says to the other one, she's like, you don't know how to read. And then they have a conversation about reading and why they don't necessarily want to read, because she doesn't want other people's ideas coming into her head and messing up what she thinks. And I just thought that was like a very interesting commentary on today's media, because today's media feeds us what we want to hear, more and more of what we want to hear, and less of like a dissenting opinion.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's called a cognitive dissonance, I think, where you know, you don't want to be uncomfortable hearing something that goes against your ideologies or your train of thought. And and yeah, it's just it's funny. It's funny and sad just how someone like these characters who you know don't have the ability to read are unwilling to even improve themselves just for the sake of they don't want that uncomfortable natural feeling that they might incur.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've had experiences, and I don't know, maybe you have as well, but with just within my counseling, where I do encounter people that are incredibly smart and, you know, also willing to consider other opinions, but they were just shoved through the system and shuffled through and never taught how to read. And then they have all this shame associated with it. So they make up different excuses. And for this girl, the excuse was like, I don't want other people putting ideas in my head, which is like an extremely ignorant thing to think. And it's also for her own protection, because she can't read. So she's like, okay, well, I'm going to continue to espouse my beliefs. And because there's no way for me to challenge these beliefs, then I'm right. And so it was just, it's like a very thorny kind of issue, I think, especially, like I said, because the media, this is kind of going off on a tangent, but the media more and more, you know, on Facebook, it's like you click an article and then it gives you five more articles that are like exactly like that article. Yeah. Instead of giving you articles with opposing views. So, you know, the technology that we have is actually kind of contributing to that in people who even can read, you know, the mindsets of people who can read, like, I'm going to feel comfortable with my position and I'm not going to reach out and actually have any sort of meaningful debate with anyone else because it threatens my worldview.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I thought that was nice because I'm not really sure how that kind of looks at like the overarching picture of the season. I'm sure it fits in somehow, but in this episode, I feel like, well, I guess it fits with Boo and Doggett because they're both kind of like from completely different sides of the rape
conversation, although Doggett's kind of trying to consider other opinions, but their Boo is very set in her, yeah, the way she, that she's going to look at the situation.
She doesn't want to have any type of sympathy for the man.
Yeah. And so it's just, I just thought that was like a super interesting, like, brief moment in the episode, because they've kind of been like the Latina girls were in past seasons, where they're kind of comic relief, but they're also saying stuff that is socially important.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. So, well, kind of to go on to the Latina girls, or Puerto Rican at the very least, Gloria and Alita kind of talk about her leaving, because she's leaving very soon. And Alita's really worried about Daya. And she asks Gloria to kind of watch over Daya. And I love Gloria, such an awesome friend. She's like always so supportive. Like, I want Gloria to be my friend because she's always so supportive, yeah, of Alita. And I mean, they're really good, you know, they're good friends and everything. But she's kind of holding her up when she's not really feeling so good about herself. And she has that really funny joke about how she's like a cockroach and she's going to be mean to all the other roaches. And I liked that a lot. But she, you know, it's just interesting because we see Alita and Daya and their mother and daughter, and now the mother is leaving and they're going to be separated. And it's just interesting. I don't have a ton of experience with like children of parents who are incarcerated. I used to work with adults. So most of the time I would work with, people who had children. They were coming out of being incarcerated or, you know, a long-term inpatient program, and they were trying to get their kids back. But I never really worked with children. But you have had previous experience kind of working with an agency that worked with children with incarcerated parents and kind of the impact of that. And I definitely wanted to hear a little bit more about that process.
Oh, yeah, sure. When I was going to graduate school at Central Connecticut State University, I was an assistant at the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy, mm-hmm, on campus. And they're a nonpartisan group that conducts independent research and evaluation, public policy analysis, and community engagement throughout Connecticut. And one of the biggest projects that they were doing while I was there that's still ongoing is the Children of Incarcerated Parents Initiative. And so what brought that on was that, you know, we've been seeing rising incarceration rates in both Connecticut and nationwide. Mm-hmm. And so as a society, we tend to neglect, mm-hmm, the children who also suffer from having a parent in prison. And I think it's like nationally 1 in 28 children have a parent,
oh, really?
In prison.
1 in 20 or 28?
So,
2-8 or 2? Oh, 28. 2-8. Okay. I mean, yeah. That's still a staggering number.
It is, yeah. And part of the work that was done was identifying the risks that children face in such a situation. I was fortunate enough to be part of a published article where I helped research statistics and passed a research face of trends facing these children. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, when the children are separated from one or more parent due to incarceration, they may suffer from negative self-image and exhibit emotional, mm-hmm, distress, such as fear, anxiety, anger, and sadness. And as a result, they may withdraw from friends and family, and they might begin to show signs of mental illness, such as depression, eating
or
disorders,
like PTSD,
sleeping disorders.
Too, right?
Yeah, definitely. Especially if they witness their parent right, actually being taken away by, right, law enforcement. That's a big factor in terms of in terms of their development. And so these are likely
to
manifest.
And that happens far more often than you'd think. Like when you just said that, not to cut you off, but I had an acquaintance when I was younger, when I was like in my teens. She was a little older than me, but she was like 20 and she had a 2-year-old child, and she wasn't doing the right thing, but she got arrested and the cops slammed her up against the car in front of her child, arrested. Like they didn't do it in a way that was thinking about the child at all. And it's hard because I feel like society doesn't really think about that impact. They just think about the immediate, like, okay, we need to arrest this person and we need to make sure they, like, you know, get their due process or whatever, but we're not thinking about the kids.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like these are likely to manifest both educational and behavior problems for these kids. And, you know, that leads to falling behind in school and, you know, exerting physical aggression towards others. Mm-hmm. And so when I was at the Institute, what we had been doing was We teamed up with two agencies in the state. One was Families in Crisis in Hartford, mm-hmm. and the other was Big Brothers Big Sisters in nice. Hartford and Bridgeport, I believe. And the goal was to have these agencies intervene with these children and sort of foster a positive family connection with them, and that could hopefully yield constructive societal benefits in the long run, like reduced recidivism. Mm-hmm. And so the Institute, their role at the time was sort of as evaluation. And so through interviews with the children, the parent or guardian that was not incarcerated, and with the mentors, we sort of measured the children's behavior, their thoughts, and general well-being. And these interviews were conducted in I think, 7-month intervals. Mm-hmm. And part of my job was helping with the data input for all the surveys that we collected. And, mm-hmm. you know, everything was entirely confidential. You know, no mm-hmm. names or addresses were out made public. But, you know, it was all part of this study. And for the most part, over time, I just my own perspective, I just started seeing measured improvements, particularly for positive growth in these children, both behavior, having a sense of a positive parental figure. Mm-hmm. And if I mean, the article that was put out a couple years later, I think the conclusion at the time was that it was too early to tell to predict any long-term outcomes for these services, but we reiterated the efforts needed to continue improving the well-being of the children. And so that's the Children of Incarcerated Parents Initiative is still going on. One of my colleagues at the Institute, she's spearheading the whole thing, and I give her a lot of respect for her efforts in dealing with this issue that, like I said, tends to go neglected in terms mm-hmm. of what we think about the criminal justice system.
And it's such an important issue, too, because you see, I mean, we saw in the very, very first episode of Orange is the New Black, Daya comes in and Alita's pissed because her daughter is in jail. And she, you know, she probably knew that it was happening, but maybe she didn't know they were going to end up at the same jail or whatever. But she smacks her in the face. and it's hard because when a parent is incarcerated and Daya didn't really appear to have a father figure, she lapsed into the life. I mean, her father figure was Cesar, who she ended up sleeping with, which is, you know, it's just as messy. It's not the same situation necessarily, but it's just as messy for a lot of other children that have parents that are in jail. And I think that it's really important to support those kids as much as we can because they're struggling. And with the increase in women being arrested, and I think the past 20 years, there's been a crazy market increase in the amount of women that have been arrested. Those kids not only go without having a father figure, they're also going without a mother, or they're either or, but, you know, a mother figure is proven to be, you know, really important in the development of children. So that's like devastating to them when they lose their mother figure.
Yeah. And just looking at the article again, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
No,
I think they specialize in studying these type of issues. And in the introduction, they even say in the years leading up to 2005, incarceration increased 57% for women.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
75%.
So it was 11 years.
Yeah, and 75% of the women being mothers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm sure. I can't even. It's just. It's tough. And we saw that in Orange is the New Black, too. In season 3, I think the first episode was like Mother's Day. And some of the mothers, even when their kids were there, they didn't really know how to connect with them or deal with them. And that's why parenting classes are so important, parenting training, and also like the program that you mentioned for having stable role models for children if their parents are incarcerated.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that's kind of what the program did. It would pair them with like a big brother, big sister, or someone in the community to sort of help guide them.
Yeah, because of the emphasis on community engagement, it was. I'm not sure the specifics in terms of how often the mentors were with the children. As far as I know, it could have just been as little as a couple hours a week. But again, it's just, you know, it's the any type of effort being put forth. You know, if, you know, to the point where, you know, may hopefully the children can, you know, every day or every week be, look forward to spending time with their mentor. If it means, you know, as a substitute for, you know, the parent who's not there, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, the long-term goal is that, you know, just reduced, prison, incarceration rates, especially, intergenerational rates.
Mm-hmm. And that would be why the study needs a little longer, because those kids have to grow up.
Yeah, exactly.
So they have to kind of see whether or not where those kids land, mm-hmm. in 10, 15 years. And hopefully they do well.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. So they'll be following them for a little while, like that, you know, like that 7-Up study. They'll follow them probably every couple of years to see how they are doing. So, you know, and you'd think, you know, maybe if Daya had, especially since Daya seems to be kind of an impressionable young woman, if she had some sort of role model that was willing to help her and guide her through some difficult situations, you could definitely see that playing out a little bit differently for her.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, even though Alita wasn't really the best mother figure, but at least she was like, I don't know, I feel like in one way, she was kind of trying to keep Daya away from what was going on in the house, but in another way, maybe not. So I don't know. But yeah, but I think it's good to have some sort of substitute for kids when, you know, nothing compares to a parent usually. But I think it's good to have some sort of substitute or some sort of positive role models for kids when they don't really have anyone else to turn to. A lot of these kids end up in, you know, foster homes, or, you know, if both of their parents are incarcerated, or if there's one parent that's stressed or taxed, they end up either in a stressful home situation, or they end up where, you know, in a foster home or with relatives who are not necessarily going to pay as much attention to them or give them as much nurturing as their parents would.
Yeah, and, you know, at least with these mentors, you know, they're there because they want to have a positive influence on these children, and that's, you know, they're there to foster that, and that's, you know, you gotta give them a lot of respect for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure there's, like, volunteer opportunities and stuff for people. You know, Big Brothers Big Sisters is definitely one, and, you know, there are definitely opportunities to mentor, you know, kids who need a little mentoring in your area.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But it's funny because, you know, Alita here is trying to get Gloria to kind of be that person to guide Daya. But Daya is, like, old enough where she doesn't want that. Mm-hmm. She's kind of like, you know, well, that's another thing we'll see in future episodes. But Alita's kind of calling upon Gloria to be that, you know, that person to guide Daya. But Daya's, you know, she's in her 20s probably. She's kind of past that point, so she's going to be making her own decisions from here on out, and we'll see how that goes throughout the rest of the season. But the other girls, Latina girls, I guess, have a very different experience in the episode, because we see Ramos at the very beginning of the episode, or in the first, you know, 15 minutes of the episode, we see Ramos and Flaca talking about the would you rather with, like, the mouse or the flies. And it's funny because the second time revisiting that and watching it, it felt almost like a horror movie in that part, because you see Humphrey kind of like hovering over them and listening to them. And it made my stomach drop because I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to me the second time around.
Yeah, the first time it didn't. I was just like, oh, okay, whatever. They're playing Would You Rather. Like, I've played Would You Rather a million times. But he's, like, lurking, and you don't really, you know, knowing the outcome was definitely a lot more, I don't know, made me really squeamish.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's how I was very squeamish when I saw the ending of this episode the first time, and it was just, like, I'm just kind of shocked that the show went there. Just, mm-hmm. You know, putting this, you know, this baby mouse in a little water dish, and, you know, forcing, you know, he put his gun to her head, mm-hmm. and, you know, I don't know if you want to get ahead of yourself, but I don't remember if the next episode she actually reveals what happened afterwards.
The next one, yeah, she'll talk to someone about it in the next episode. So we do get a little follow up in the next episode about it, and but this episode, even though obviously most people binge it straight through, this episode doesn't really leave you. It just leaves you hanging on the storyline. You know, she's got the gun to her head. We don't even know what, you know, what she chooses, if she gets out of it, what happens. And so, you know, it was just horrific. But I think one of the things I keep thinking of, especially when I think of that scene in particular, is I know a lot of one of the big blowbacks to the season of Orange is the New Black was how they portrayed veterans in the season. And we really haven't talked about this much on the podcast yet, but I know maybe a little bit, but I know that the veterans are obviously portrayed as incompetent and sadistic and all sorts of other really negative things. And I know, you know, I can definitely understand why the veteran community would be upset by that.
Yeah, I actually, now that you mentioned it, I don't recall seeing any type of anything in the press saying that there was a blowback against how veterans were portrayed. I mean, was there anything specific? Like, was there a veterans group that spoke out against it?
I remember seeing a couple articles from an organization called Got Your Six, which I guess means got your back. But they wrote an article just basically about the heinous treatment of veterans on the show. And I remember seeing like a smattering of other pieces as well. And I feel like it may have occurred to me at one point, too, like maybe at the end of the episode, maybe the part. There's a part later where one of the other veterans starts talking about really sadistic, horrible things in like a very cool light, and he's very like nonchalant about it, and I think that's when it struck me. I was kind of like, this is not like, this doesn't represent all vet, like maybe some veterans or maybe veterans who have severe PTSD, but I just, in a way, I think I've said this on the podcast before, I do feel like the show was really trying in a way perhaps to show that these people were not maybe vetted appropriately. Maybe they have issues with PTSD, and those people who aren't necessarily healthy emotionally or psychologically aren't necessarily in the best position to be caring for inmates. And I think that that's maybe what they were saying, but yeah, it kind of got lost.
You make a good point, because it just seems like throughout the season, like brick by brick, they're sort of portraying these new wave of guards as, you know, sadistic, abusive, discriminatory, and that all culminates towards the end, which, you know, I won't get into right now, but it just seems like that scene with Ramos, that was just sort of like another building block saying, okay, you're, as an audience, you're supposed to be rooting against the guards, and so that's why something I think we'll get in later is how Flores was doing the civil disobedience protesting. And so it's just, all of a sudden, you know, bits and pieces of the inmates are now rising up against the guards. But with, Ramos, you know, this is just another notch in terms of, you know, why we as an audience should be hating them.
Right. Yeah. And it's such a, it's, given all of the horrific, terrible things that have happened on Orange is the New Black, this is probably one of the, at least the top three. Like, it definitely beats Piper being branded with a swastika, which is probably, you know, so thus far in the season, one of the most horrific moments to happen in season four. But, I mean, you know, there's more stuff coming. But, you know, it feels like a horror movie where she's brought in and she's made to make this disgusting, she's forced to make this just like this awful decision. And it takes away, you know, it takes away a lot of her humanity. And she's, you know, that actress does a very good job in that. I think her name's Diane Guerrero. She does a great job throughout the season as Ramos too, but you know, she does a good job of kind of trying to balance out her horror and trying to like get out of the situation and trying to deal with it. And, you know, next episode too, like I said, we'll kind of see the fallout from that too. And she's really great there as well.
Yeah. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, not all these inmates are like hardened criminals who commit violent crimes. Mm-hmm. And if I recall when they did her backstory, she just tried to, what was it? She tried to steal something?
Well, she stole a car, but she got away with it. So it's one of those cases kind of like we're going to talk about Flores, where we see her do something like illegal or something shocking, but it's not necessarily what got her arrested. So I always kind of think about like Al Capone. Like Al Capone did all this terrible stuff, but then he got away, like he got caught for tax evasion. So we don't really know what these ladies got caught for. Like maybe they got caught for like stealing a candy bar at a store. Like you don't really know. Or, you know, in Ramos's case, she was stealing cars, but maybe she got arrested. Maybe she eventually got into drugs or something. You know, we don't really know what her path was, but it looks like she's relatively innocent in what she's not innocent. She stole like a Ferrari, but who's that really hurting? I mean, that's she, hurting
she's not,
she, rich
she's
white
not
people.
As much of a danger compared to others.
Right, right, true. And, you know, so she, and she happens to be cute and sweet, but she is, you know, running a drug operation from, so I guess she did eventually get into drugs because she is running a drug operation pretty much single-handedly for Maria inside the prison. So, you know, and she's trying to get out of it, but then the guard, or she does get out of it, but then the guard kind of, you know, is, abuses her anyway.
Yeah, and so that also brings up, like, even if she, on the outside beforehand, if she never got into, like, the drug trade, some of the things you hear about serving time in prison is that it makes you a better criminal. And so mm-hmm. if she's learning, you know, how to navigate drugs in and out of prison, if and when she's ever released, you know, is she going to take that skill? And if she can't find a legitimate job, right. Is she going to do that in order to make ends meet? Mm-hmm. And then is that cycle going to repeat itself where she gets caught again and she's back in prison?
I like how you call it a skill, because I think we talked about that. I don't know if it was last podcast, but I've talked about that before, about how drug dealing is really a skill. It's like something that you have to learn, and it is for all intents and purposes, it's a job, and it's a job that sometimes pays extremely well, but it's a job where you have to have skills, and those skills can be extrapolated and used for other things. And Ramos has seen that, you know, she uses her feminine wiles quite frequently to get what she wants. And she can, you know, and I think at one point Piper even kind of says in the episode, like, I've learned to use my sexuality as currency as a female or something. And Ramos has got that down. Uh-huh. And so she knows how to do that. And she knows she's pretty quick, even though people underestimate her quite frequently, but obviously, you know, she didn't deserve this, and it's something that we're gonna kind of see play out in the future too. And it was just very very jarring and very traumatic for even the viewers, I think.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
but we, you know, another pairing in the episode is Red and Nikki. And this is, you know, we've seen Nikki unraveling, and like I was talking about Piper kind of mentions she feels a little guilty joining in on the whole crack in the corn session. But she and Alex is kind of like she can't be helped, and crack is kind of like an, you know, a what did she say, like an appetizer or something?
Or potato chips to Nikki.
Yeah, potato chips. And I would argue otherwise, because crack is extremely addictive. But but I think, you know, Alex is kind of has the mentality of someone who's been a drug dealer for a really long time. And she still kind of has that skill where she's kind of turns that part of her brain off. And she's like, I don't really necessarily want to feel pity or any sort of anything for people who are using, because they're her bread and butter. So Alex is, although Alex does have a point, she's like, Nikki doesn't really want to be helped, and she doesn't. And then when Red finds her, it's like a very emotional scene between the two of them.
Yeah, because I'm trying to remember Nikki's backstory, where her own mother was very I think she visited Nikki when she was in the hospital after an overdose. Mm-hmm. And her mom was like almost broke down crying because she felt that she failed her as a mother looking after her child.
Well, though. She was not a good mom. Yeah. was a terrible mom.
And then with Red at the beginning of the series, she's like a motherly figure to Nikki. Mm-hmm. And
she's,
you know,
a good mom.
Yeah. So she legitimately wants to look out for her. Mm-hmm. And then it's just when in this episode, when Red finds her in the shower and she just starts breaking down, it's just you legitimately feel bad for Red, because again, she's in the position where she feels she's failed keeping Nikki safe. And mm-hmm. I mean, I think, what was it, the middle of the third season where Nikki went to maximum security?
The very beginning. I think it's like the third episode of the third season. It's pretty.
Yeah, and that was kind of a disappointment, because, you know, Nikki is one of those, you know, favorite characters, and mm-hmm. you know, you had no idea if she was ever going to return. And then mm-hmm. I think the first scene she's in this season is she's in the that whatever alcohol or Narcotics mm-hmm. Anonymous group, and she has hit a sobriety milestone. And so you see, you know, an actual positive outlook for Nikki, at least in terms of her drug addiction. And it's just, for me, it's like, there's certain TV characters that I've come to love, and they're flawed, and, but, you know, they have addictions. And there's, I mean, one of my favorite shows of all time is the Sopranos. And my favorite character on that is, Christopher Moltisanti. I'm not sure. Have you watched that series?
Oh, I haven't. I watched the first couple episodes a couple times, and I think I need to revisit it, because I watched it when I was like younger. I think I was in college and I was like going for my psychology degree, and I was kind of just like, I don't know, he frustrated me a lot. So I think I need to revisit it at some point in time, but I have not watched the full Sopranos.
Okay, well, I mean,
but it's okay. You can ruin things for me. I already know that some people die. Just
halfway through the season, he develops a heroin addiction, and he gets to the point where there's an intervention. He goes to rehab. He comes out. He's clean and sober for a temporary time period. You know, he even stays off alcohol, but just the life he lives, there's too much pressure to indulge in substances. And unfortunately, his addictions catch up back to him, and he doesn't die of an overdose, but it's just his addictions lead to his ultimate fate. And it's just one of those things that I always, you know, writers of TV shows, they're intentionally trying to create conflict, especially mixed emotions with the audiences. And so that's how I felt this season on Orange is the New Black, where they're smoking crack in the cornfield. And it's just, you know, seeing her resort back to that state was just really hard to watch. And so now it seems like, I think in the end of this episode, Nikki goes back to Red, and generally you feel like she wants to get clean once and for all.
Yeah, and I think it's, you definitely brought up a lot of really good points there. And I think one of the things, you know, media likes addiction because it does provide some of that conflict within us. Like, we love this person, but addiction makes them do terrible things. And sometimes, like, addiction's a scapegoat. and addiction is so complicated, too. You know, like, Nikki, at this point, just in my like clinical opinion of the character, like, she doesn't really want to change. Like, she's, but she's also like trapped in a way where she can't, she doesn't feel like she can stop. And so when she sees Red, she wants to kind of make that okay for Red, because Nikki is nothing but a people pleaser. Like, she likes to like kind of project her stuff onto other people. Like, she's a helper. She doesn't really like to focus on her own stuff because it's too painful for her. So she wants to focus on other people. So when Red comes to her, she's like, okay, I'll make this half-hearted attempt for Red, but she's not really doing it. Like Alex said, she's not really doing it for herself. She's like, I'm going to do this for Red. So, but I also really, just as someone who's seen people relapse over the years, like, I felt for Red, because Red is like, she feels just like helpless. Like, she doesn't know what to do. And instead of really giving Nikki an ultimatum, like, she learned her lesson from the first season where she gave Trish an ultimatum and said, you're out of the family because you relapsed. She's like, giving an ultimatum never works, just for anyone out there who's going through a situation where they have someone that they know who's addicted. Like, that's a terrible idea, because really change has to come from within. And so Red is going about it in a really good way. She's just like, help me, like Jerry Maguire, like, help me help you.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she's also kind of giving Nikki like a guilt. She's unknowingly giving Nikki a guilt trip. And so Nikki's like, okay, I'll try. Like, I'll try for you. Like, I don't really want it, but like, I will try for you. And so it's just a really heartbreaking scene, because there's all these emotions going on, and like, the addiction has taken hold, and everyone feels helpless. Like, even Nikki feels helpless.
And I was actually wondering, like, since you mentioned that you've been a substance abuse therapist, do you find this portrayal or the portrayal of addiction on the series realistic in terms of what you've seen?
Well, I mean, everyone's kind of unique and different, but I think Nikki's path is just kind of what happened to her is very realistic. Like, she is in jail, she gets her chip, she's stressed, she's like, has easy access to it, and she sees this horrific thing in Sophia's shoe cell, and she just can't take it anymore, so she needs something to numb. And then once she does it, at one point in the past couple episodes, she tells Piper, or maybe it's next episode, but it's okay, but she tells Piper, like, I had 3 years, and Piper says something along the lines of, like, that's great, like, you had 3 years, but Nikki feels like she's thrown all of that away. And so something that I would tell my clients would be like, okay, well, you had that 3 years and it doesn't go away entirely. Like, you do have to start over, which is really hard for some people to start over because they're like, why would I start over when I'm just going to fail again? Because that's kind of how it feels. But you had these 3 years. So what did you do in those 3 years that made you successful? And for Nikki, it's like indulging in sex addiction.
Yeah.
but she was clean and she was healthy and she was like doing relatively well, like better than, you know, she was when she was using heroin. So just a long story short, I definitely find it realistic. And the thing I found most realistic was a point where, Red is crying and she's saying to Nikki, it looks like you're dead already. And for me, I used to say, like, some of my clients that would be walking through hallways, sometimes they would look literally like ghosts. They would look dead and just like walking around and dead, like whether or not they were on substances or coming down from substances or whatever. And then they would go to rehab and they'd be like a person again. And or the opposite would happen, which is, you know, really terrible and upsetting. But addiction is definitely powerful. And I think that this was a really exemplary example of how addiction can harm families.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I gotta give you credit for, I mean, what you do, because like I said, with my, the prison, tour, you know, I just, for me, I couldn't personally handle that type of, that environment, but for you, just to, able to do that, and it's just, just, you know, a lot of respect for what you do.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I used to work in methadone clinics, but then I worked in I think I said it before, but it was a legally mandated, mostly legally mandated, some not, but it was an outpatient clinic. So most of those individuals were pretty high functioning. So they like had jobs and they like did their thing. But, you know, I there's things, you know, everyone, there's things that people like to do and people don't like to do. I just happen to really enjoy working with people with, I mean, not enjoy, because I don't love addiction, but, but I like helping people through that process. And there's pros and cons, and it's always a struggle. But I always say, you know, you gotta redefine success when you work in a field like that, mental health or addiction, because a lot of times people get discouraged really quickly, and clinicians too get discouraged very quickly. And so you have to redefine success. Like for Nikki with her 3 years, like she relapsed, and that's a huge failure for her. But like, what's like a step in the right direction? What's like a small success she can have to help her get back on track? That's what I would say if I was her counselor.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, but I think I do think that, you know, that scene is, it definitely made me feel very emotional, just, you know, and just as viewers too. I think anyone, you know, every single person's life has been touched by addiction in some way or another, and so I think everyone can kind of relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And so, well, so aside from that, there's a lot of heavy lifting going on in this episode. And I know, you know, Sister, we talked a little bit about her before, but she is really serious about getting into the shoe, and her attempts are kind of funny at first. Like I said, she's kind of tormenting Charlie Donuts a little bit, and he's like, oh, what's going on? And then she pops out with a cigarette looking like a boss.
Yeah.
and McCullough comes up to her and takes a drag off her cigarette and says, you're feeling frisky, and kind of just lets her go on her way. And so, you know, I guess good thing she never came up against Piscatella, but I guess my assumption would be if she had come up against Piscatella, Piscatella probably would have treated her in a very similar way, because she's an old lady who doesn't really cause a lot of trouble, and the shoe is full too, so obviously no one wants to send her to the shoe.
Yeah.
But she eventually gets really serious, and Gloria steps up as the best friend ever in the prison right now, and she lets Sister clock her in the face.
and actually, what was happening in the cafeteria leading up to that? She was playing with the battery.
Yeah, she was trying to light her food on fire, I think. Like, she was trying to, like, light a pile of napkins on something.
Oh, okay.
She was trying to start a fire. And Gloria was just kind of like, what is going on? So she helped her get into the shoe. And she's in there with a, you know, cell phone stuffed somewhere very uncomfortable. And so what has she done? What has she gotten herself into?
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, it was kind of playful at first, but then that look on her face when she actually sees the confinement space that she's going to be in for who knows how long. And, you know, that look on her face, like, mm-hmm. You know, what did I just do?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, what did I get myself into?
Plus, you know, her whole mission is to find Sophia, and, you know, what if she doesn't find her? What if, even if she's there, what if they're separated to the point where they never see each other?
Right. Like, how am I going to handle this? And that's definitely, you know, going to be a challenge for her as things goes on, but, or as the season goes on. But, you know, that kind of starts the whole, there's two kind of threads running through this episode with the shoe, with drama, with the shoe being overcrowded, one being Sister. And then the second one is Flores. And we haven't really talked a lot about Flores yet. Her flashbacks kind of go throughout this episode, but she, I do have to say, she's one of the characters, like, I don't really like her, but, like, I don't find too much redeeming about her. Like, she's smart, and she's kind of trying to play the game here, but she's trying to play the game because she's doing something illegal. She doesn't want to get searched because they have drugs on them or contraband or whatever. And she shouldn't be playing the game because they're obviously profiling and stopping and frisking the Dominicans more than anyone else. So she does kind of have a point, but she's also on the other side of the coin. She's engaging in illegal activity, so she's not totally, it's kind of like the Doggett and Boo thing. It's like, you know, the lady that she killed, you know, there's two sides to every story. So I think and in addition to that, I don't really think the flashback served to give her, I don't know, to like humanize her at all, or to give us much more information on her. It just made me kind of dislike her more. Even though, like, I got what she was doing with the rich white lady she worked for, and that lady was horrible and she definitely had it coming, but it was just like off to me. I didn't really like her flashback.
I mean, it wasn't the perfect story to tell in terms of her past. I don't recall, was she introduced in this season?
No, oh no, she actually, in the very first season, I don't know if it was in the first episode or not, but she was the woman in the stall who is talking to Diablo, and Piper thought that everyone thought she was crazy, but she was actually talking on her cell phone to Diablo. And then we see Diablo in this episode, which is actually really funny because finally we get to see the face of Diablo, who from season one we heard her talking to.
Okay, so. Yeah, now I remember that. But like with the flashback, I just felt like because she never really seemed happy in prison, but then the way I saw it is when she meets Diablo, she sort of has a sense of happiness in her newfound attraction towards him. Mm-hmm. And to the point where now they're basically seen screwing in her boss's bedroom. Yeah. And she gets when her boss wakes, and you know, Flores is giving that eye stare, and it's just like, mm-hmm, she knows exactly what she's doing. But there was no indication of, was there any indication of why she's in prison?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess, like, no, I don't. I mean, I guess you could assume that, like, maybe her and Diablo got into something later, but, like, maybe not. Who knows? You know, maybe she killed that lady. Who knows why she's in, like, I don't know if I'd be able to put up with that lady for too much longer, but I don't think you, that's the other thing. Like, I don't think you can really extrapolate what she did, because obviously, I mean, I don't even know if what she did was illegal, having sex with the guy in front of her boss. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's illegal. It's like a very weird situation. So I don't know what would have been the grounds for that had the lady called the police or something. But it was definitely a very creative way to show her displeasure with the situation she was in with the lady. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't really love Flores. And I don't think you're supposed to either.
I think I'm only guessing that her flashback was sort of to coincide with the events in this episode, starting with her not showering to putting, mm-hmm, you know, rotten food on her body, and mm-hmm, then to the very end where she stands up on top of the table, and
mm-hmm, which is definitely a powerful thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, because as you mentioned, the Dominicans were being targeted, especially, but like, I mean, I support her for her nonviolent protest. I mean, coming from me as a straight white male, I've never really felt oppressed by systemic institutions, so mm-hmm, I don't have the same experience as either women or persons of color. But I still, mm-hmm, you know, I guess I respect her initiative at this point in the season. And you know, I think is that the very last scene of the episode? And so
I What is the last scene of the episode? I think it's close. It's like very close. The very last scene of the episode is the two guards talking about it. The guy with like the beard and like the kind of balding head, and then like the fat guy with the red hair, and they're talking about it. And clearly, I've never bothered to learn many of the guards' names.
Yeah,
I just was like, I'm not gonna. They have names, but I'm just like, nah, whatever. I'm not gonna learn their names. But yeah, it's them like looking in at her from like that mesh fence from the like the rec room or whatever. And one guy is like, the guy who made her stand up on the table is kind of like, I think I made a mistake. And then they like zoom in on Flores's face, and then that awesome song starts playing.
Yeah, and so that's sort of like that leaves you on a cliffhanger. You don't know how they're going to proceed with controlling the situation. So, and obviously, you know, we got 3 episodes left this season. And so that sort of steamrolls into the events that unfold over the next 3 episodes.
Oh, I think there's 4, right? 4? Because there's 10.
Oh, yeah, you're 10, correct. 11, 12, yeah, 4.
Yeah, but no, that's definitely true. And 10 is, you know, it's another one where it's kind of setting stuff up. And then 11, 12, and 13 are just basically like huge punches and kind of everything comes together in a big way, including this stuff with Flores too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, at least, you know, for your podcast, I definitely look forward to how you and your other guests dismantle the emotional highs and lows that follow the next 4 episodes.
I know. Well, and we are doing, we're recording this right on Monday at like 4 or 5 o'clock, but we've been doing live tweets of every episode. And I think that's really important because a lot of times when people binge, they don't really get the full... They don't, you know, like with Walking Dead or Game of Thrones or any other Grey's Anatomy, whatever show that people live tweet, they get a chance to like join in on the conversation and hear other viewpoints and things like that. And so we're on the You've Got Time handle on Twitter, which is at You've Got Time Pod. We're tweeting this episode tonight at 9 o'clock, but this will not go up before then. This is going up a couple days later. But then next week on August 22nd, which is a Monday at 9 o'clock Eastern time, we are going to live tweet episode 10, and then we're going to do the same thing every week until they're all over so that we can talk about them.
Yeah, and you know, Twitter's and live tweeting is a great forum for, you know, a shared experience, especially because I don't know if binge watching cheapens the experience, because I mean, definitely when it comes to a show like this, I'll watch a full season, you know, usually within a week after its release, and but then you have others who either just don't have the time immediately, or they just set their own schedule. And for me, it's definitely hard. Like for a show like this, I can't like set aside like, okay, I'm going to watch the first episode once a week, watch each episode once a week at a set time and space it out.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Because even though we've been, as you know, we grew up in, you know, network and cable television where you know, you had to tune in, and even before DVR has been such a made me like a spoiled brat because of it, because I watch whatever I record whenever I want in my own convenience. But back in the day, if you missed your favorite show 8 p.m. on a network, then you probably won't see it again until the summer rerun. So we've definitely been spoiled, but yeah, I like hearkening back to that shared experience of everyone watching it at a certain time.
Yeah, and I just, for Orange is the New Black, and I sound like a broken record because I think I say this on a lot of podcasts, but I feel like, you know, I love The Walking Dead and I love Game of Thrones, but those are shows that people just obsess over every single little nitpicky, gritty thing in every episode. And because it's on every week and we have these 6 days or 7 days in between every episode so that we can absorb it and think about it critically. But with Orange is the New Black, which brings up all of these like super important points, like we're not talking like zombies and dinosaurs here. We're talking mass incarceration and racism, which are problems that face our society today. And I think that it's important to just to have that conversation with people and start thinking a little bit deeper about those issues and talking to other people about it, because we obviously don't want to be like the white supremacists and close out other opinions.
Yeah, and now I'm wondering, you know, like, has there ever been like a formal study like you know, what's the Orange is the New Black effect in terms of how we perceive the criminal justice system, how we perceive inmates, in particular women inmates. And so, you know, are we able to empathize with them, even if they, committed a horrific crime, we still have to view them as humans.
Right, and they are. And I mean, I don't think there have been any studies about that, but I actually did. I've been working with a woman to try to get her team on for an episode about educational programs in prison. And she and her team have been in prisons for about 20 years. And she said in the last like year and a half, there have been some restrictions lifted. And she thinks that's probably in part, maybe not in whole, but in part due to the fact that there are more representations of people in prison on television, because I mean, obviously too, we're in peak TV, so more people can tell more stories, but I think that that's part of that too, because you know, Orange is the New Black is humanizing these women and other shows as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what it is in the long run.
Mm-hmm, that's true. Someone should do that study. I don't even know. I was never great at like getting studies together when I did my experimental psychology. So if you have friends who want to do a study on Orange is the New Black, that would be fun.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, if your subject it has to be, you know, an entertaining television show that, you know, mm-hmm. there's no downside to the research you do.
Right, that's true. You just have to watch a fun TV show. Well, yeah. Not fun all the time, but you know, a captivating television show, and then tell us what you think about it. And mm-hmm. I think it'll probably be interesting, you know, kind of like the study with the children, you know, in 10-20 years, maybe see if there's an impact on society based on the entry of Orange is the New Black into our cultural consciousness and how much that affected things. But I do think that other, you know, politicians have been talking about it a little more, because it's a national crisis, the mass incarceration, and it's something that we very desperately need to address, and you know, us having conversations about it is the first step.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah, but I think we covered almost everything in the episode. Anything that we're missing?
No, that was pretty well done. I mean, it was a lot longer than the average episode of the show.
You know, they're getting longer and longer as we reach the end, I think. But yeah, I think we covered everything. And for listeners, you guys can join in on the live tweet on Mondays at 9 o'clock at You've Got Time Pod. And every week at the very top of the Twitter page, I put whatever episode that we're talking about, and we really, you know, episodes 9 is tonight, but you guys are gonna miss that. 10 is next week, and then 11, 12, and 13, we really want people to, you know, we'd love to hear from people to join in on the conversation about those, because those are super heavy episodes that I think we could all use a little trauma processing about, because they're very heavy and a lot of stuff happens in them. And in addition to that, you can reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/YouveGotTimePodcast and on Gmail or email at YouveGotTimePodcast@gmail.com. So thanks.